Hi there, it's Ed here with a short message before we start the pod this week. Did you know that our most informed investors get insights, articles, and investment ideas from Tom, me, and the team sent directly to them via email, and it is completely free. You can join them. Just subscribe at fidelity.co.uk/newsletters. Hello and welcome to The Personal Investor. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, markets are hitting new highs around the world. What fear should that hold for investors? We're going to look at what history tells us about investing near the top of the market. And then with the end of the financial year in view, we'll take a mathematical look at that vital question, ISA or pension. If you enjoy the show, please do rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Stock markets in the US and in Europe, in Japan and in India have hit new highs recently. Other assets like gold and Bitcoin are breaking new ground as well. It all has some investors questioning whether the good times can continue and asking what lies around the corner if they don't. How much should you be protecting against the downside right now? And what does history tell us about investing at the top of the market? To talk it over with me is Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, welcome along. We're also going to look today, with the end of the tax year upon us, at how you can work out the most advantageous home for your cash in terms of tax-efficient savings. That means ISAs and pensions, of course. But Tom, let's start with markets and my introduction there. As I've said, some markets are at high levels. What evidence is there that those high levels are unjustified?
Yes. Well, as you say, you know, quite a wide range of markets are hitting new record highs at the moment. And I think the evidence is quite sort of finely balanced, actually, as to whether they're too high or whether it's justified. I mean, I think, you know, the case for saying that markets are too high focuses in part on valuations. We've seen a big uplift in valuations in some markets, the US in particular, where back at the market low last October, markets were trading at about 15 times expected earnings, and now more than 20 times. So that's quite a valuation uplift. I think just the breadth of the number of new highs, the number of markets which are hitting new highs, and also the fact that in some cases investors seem to be chasing momentum. Yeah. So they seem to be buying what's going up. Indeed, in some cases, you mentioned Bitcoin and gold. I mean, these are two assets which you would not expect to perform well at the same time. They both are. And that's indicative to me of the fact that some people are just buying what's rising.
Yeah, look, you've mentioned some of the numbers there, but there is this behavioural side to this, and you've written about this, you flagged some of those issues. You also said, I won't take this personally, Tom, but you said that some of your younger colleagues were rushing into some assets that were already quite highly valued, and this was sort of, you know, setting your internal sort of dash lights going a bit.
Yeah, well, it's that old saying, isn't it, about, you know, when the shoeshine boy gives you share tips. I mean, you know, I can't remember the last time I saw a shoeshine boy, but anyway, you understand that the point that when people who are not, you wouldn't necessarily think were experts in stock market investments, start talking to you about stock market investments. And that is beginning to happen, you know. I mean, you know, having conversations with people about Bitcoin,
Nvidia.
And suddenly it's on people's radars, and that's an indication of that we may be approaching a high point. But I think, you know, you can argue the other way, that in some ways the current levels of markets are justified. I mean, I think if you just look at the length of the bull market, I mean, you know, arguably shares have been rising for about 15 years, and that seems like a long time, but we have had bull markets which have run on for much longer than that, in the 1980s and 90s, for example. I think also the scale of the most recent leg up in the market is not that great. When you look at the historic track record of bull markets, you know, the market is up by about, well, nearly 50% since the October 2022 low. That's good, but actually bull markets tend to go on further than that. So the fact that it's risen by 50%, I don't think is a particular worry. And I think that the most impressive stat for me on this is that typically at a market high, the most in favor stocks trade at a massive premium to the rest of the market. And we saw this in the dot-com bubble mm-hmm. years, of course. Typically they will have valuations which are twice as high as the rest of the market. And at the moment, these mega cap stocks that are leading the market are trading at maybe 30-40% higher yeah. than the rest of the market. What that's telling me is that to a large extent, this very strong performance of those shares is justified by their earnings performance.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's the more positive sort of way of looking at this. But just to be a bit gloomy for a moment, Tom, you spent a good chunk of last week looking at some numbers on what has happened previously in history when markets have hit new highs, and in particular, sort of the worst case scenarios when that has happened. What did you find out?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's valid when markets are riding high to sort of think about the risk and reward balance, and to understand that properly, you have to understand what has happened historically from periods of very very high stock markets. So I looked at some data which have been put together for UBS. It used to be a Credit Suisse publication, the Global Investment Returns Yearbook, it's called. It's put together by some professors from the London Business School and Cambridge University. And they've got this fantastic database going back from more than about 125 years now of stock market data. And you can learn quite a lot from reading the history. So, I mean, I think what it shows is that, you know, there have been some periods when there have been very big, what they call drawdowns, so a peak to trough fall in the market, very substantial in some cases, 60-70%. We're talking about the Wall Street crash. We're talking about the performance of markets after the oil crisis in the 1970s, after the dot-com bubble burst in 1999. And it also looked at the time that it took investors to get back to square one, in fact, to get their head above water, if you like, from those. And those periods can be quite lengthy at times. For example, well, I mean, the most extreme example, of course, is the Japanese stock market. We've just seen the Japanese market go through its 1989 high point after 34 years. But other examples, I mean, after the Wall Street crash in 1929, it took nearly 16 years for markets to get back to their previous highs. So, you know, this is what can happen if you're unlucky and invest at exactly the top of the market.
Yeah, and there are a couple of things to say. A, you know, we're hitting new highs in markets. That's not to say they might not go higher. In these instances that you're looking at is with hindsight, looking at where the market has peaked and then fallen. But as you say, you know, they are the worst case scenarios. It isn't always true, though, is it, Tom, that investing near the top of the market does hurt you? Because we've done some work earlier this year, and lots of similar work exists that's out there, and it looked at returns, average returns following new all-time highs for the US market that we looked at. And it showed that both on a three-year annualized return and a five-year annualized return, the returns following an all-time high were lower, which is what you would logically expect, versus the kind of average long-term return, but only marginally so. And I think what the numbers we looked at, that the annualized return fell from about 11% down to about 10%. Now, a lot of that is back in history during sort of, you know, higher growth periods than perhaps we're in now. But it goes to show, doesn't it, that it even if you get your timing wrong from a market point of view, markets generally rise, and you can still make a positive return that's pretty good, even if you get your timing wrong.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the key point there is that markets do rise over time. So even if you are investing at a peak, then, you know, it might take you a bit longer to get to where you want to get to. But the chances are that if you're patient enough, you will get there. And I was kind of reminded of this with some work that I'm doing this week, actually, to coincide with the 25th anniversary of the launch of the ISA, the individual savings account in 1999. And I was thinking, you know, 1999 actually was potentially a very bad time to launch an ISA because it was very close to the top of the market. And, you know, a lot of people who got into ISAs in the early days might have had quite a bad experience of the stock market. Actually, if you look at the long-term returns, they've been very good. I mean, people, there's a sort of widely held myth that the UK stock market has really done nothing over the last 20, 25 years. And at the headline level, that's true. The FTSE 100 is up about 20% from its level back then in 1999, which is not a great return for 25 years of investment risk. But if you factor in the reinvestment of dividends, then yeah, that 20% turns into about 180%. So £100 invested in 1999 in the FTSE 100, if you'd reinvested your dividends, would be worth nearly £300 now. And actually, if you'd invested in the FTSE 250 on the same basis, reinvested your dividends, that £100 is now worth £700.
Wow.
So, you know, that's an example of investing at the top of the market, doing the sensible thing, reinvesting your dividends, being patient, and actually the returns have been, you know, quite acceptable.
And another point to make about that start date for ISAs, this is sort of besides the point, not the point you were making, but an interesting one, I think. Actually, yes, you kind of walked into a big stock market crash at the start of that of the lifetime of ISAs, you could say. But actually, if you're a long-term investor and you invest through that, that's exactly what you want. Right at the start, you know, big, you know, prices fall, your first year or two of contributions would have suffered very badly, but then you've got a nice low starting point for all the time that comes afterwards.
Absolutely. And this is actually sort of, I'm slightly preempting what maybe we'll talk about in a subsequent podcast, because it's something I'm writing about this week, is that actually one of the reasons why the outcomes for investors investing in their ISAs over that period have been so good is because of the structure, the format of an ISA, which encourages people to invest on an annual basis because there's a use it or lose it annual allowance. It forces you to invest through the market cycle, and actually that means that people will, you know, anyone who was serious about investing in this tax efficient way would have benefited from buying assets at low prices.
Yeah, and this has been a slight tangent, Tom, because we were talking about market highs and what happens afterwards. And I was going to make the point that we always warn investors against making very sweeping changes to their portfolios, don't we? Because, you know, you might look at the situation today, you might see these risks. We spoke about them, you know, almost weekly now, you know, highs for markets, big highs for the biggest companies, concentration of risk inside the Magnificent Seven and all the rest of it. The problem is that, you know, if you try and take account for that in a kind of significant way within your portfolio, you risk chasing your tail a little bit, don't you? Look, we could have had a conversation a few months back along very similar lines. I mean, yes, valuations might have become more stretched since then, but the rationale would have been the same. You know, reduce exposure to the biggest stocks, reduce your exposure to the US, go for less highly valued assets. And there would be good sense in that, but you would have missed out on a big leg up in the market, right? And a lot of the recent returns have been driven by that. A loss and a fall may come along, but it's against the backdrop of those assets having gained a lot. So knowing exactly what to do and making big decisions on the back of it is dangerous.
Yeah, and you mentioned the US market, and is that what you say is absolutely correct about the US market, but it's also true of other markets. I mean, you know, we could have had the same conversation, say, about the Japanese market at the beginning of the year, and I, you know, indeed, I remember writing about it, you know, 3 months ago and saying, you know, actually, it's had a fantastic run in 2023. It's no longer as cheap as it was. Maybe you'd want to think about reducing your exposure to Japan. It's continued to be the best performing market. So the herd can be right, except at the very extremes. Except at the very extremes, at the beginning and the ends of the cycles.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Tom, let's move on for now and spend some time on a question which I think is very relevant as we get to the end of another financial year, which is where you should be investing your money for the biggest tax boost. So we're talking tax vehicles, and that means ISAs and pensions, of course. Now, these are, of course, the flagship methods for investing tax efficiently, and you'd think, Tom, given that their weight, their kind of mainstream appeal, that it would be easy to decide between them. It's not always the case, is it, to decide whether the ISA or a pension is the best home for your cash.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the reasons for that is that they share some similarities. I mean, you know, an ISA and a SIP, a pension will allow you to save in a tax advantaged way. You won't pay any capital gains tax on your investments as they grow. You won't pay any income tax on the dividend income that you earn in them. So in that regard, they're similar. They shelter you from tax, but they do it in a very different way. You know, the ISA essentially is invested out of already taxed income, and the pension is invested out of income that hasn't yet been taxed, and that makes a fundamental difference to the circumstances in which one is more favourable than the other.
Yeah, and look, when people decide between saving inside a pension or an ISA, a big part of that decision is going to come down to the practicalities of being able to access money at certain times. If you need your money at any point, a pension probably isn't the place for it, because unless you want to pay very, very punitive tax charges, you're not going to be able to get that money until age 55 currently, but it's going to be 57 before too long. And ideally, you're going to have it there for your retirement. So it's got a set purpose and limits on when you can get your money. And that will dictate to a large part, you know, when people go for ISA versus pension. However, for a lot of people, especially as they get older to that retirement point, the penalty of having your money tied up in a pension is far less, because you don't have to wait as long. And simply some people are just going to want to invest in the most tax advantageous way they possibly can. That's what we've been looking at internally over the last week or so, because it's difficult actually to find proper numbers on this. So we tried to put some numbers on exactly what contributing to an ISA means versus a pension. The difficulty comes really with the pension side of things, because of what you say, the way this system of tax relief works, and the fact that 25% of your money in a pension can be withdrawn tax-free, subject to certain allowances, we should say. So what we tried to do was to produce some numbers which showed what we'll call the uplift on your pension contributions. So they take account of the tax relief, and they take account of the 25% of tax-free cash that you can get inside pensions. And they show that if you're able to contribute at one rate of tax, but then withdraw at a lower rate of tax, you can get quite significant uplifts from a pension. So for example, if you're a 40% taxpayer, Tom, and you make a contribution to your pension, and you withdraw your pension at 40% again, the uplift is almost 17% of your money, just because of that tax relief, because of the 25% tax-free cash. But if you're able to withdraw at a lower rate, at say 20%, the uplift jumps to almost 42%, which is a really significant boost on your money. And basically the pattern is repeated. The higher your rate on the way in and the lower the rate on your way out, the bigger the boost. And it's not always appreciated, is it, that kind of effect within pensions?
I think that that's not well understood by a lot of people, because you sort of think, well, I'm a 40% taxpayer, that's what I'm going to be paying for the rest of my life. But the reality is that many people will be in work and paying a higher rate of tax, but when they retire, the threshold is, you know, I can't remember the exact figure, but it's roughly £50,000. For many people, their retirement income will be below £50,000 a year. So I think that sequence of earning and paying tax at 40% and then paying 20% tax in retirement is actually quite a usual situation. For many people, that will be the case. And that's where the pension really, really kicks in and becomes very attractive.
Yeah, and what these figures show, and I'll point people to where they can find these numbers and have a look for themselves, because it's difficult to kind of relay them all on a podcast, but they really show that in most circumstances, as long as access to your money isn't an issue, as we've said, if you're looking for just the most advantageous place to save, pensions normally are the place. I mean, there are circumstances, if for some reason you went on to pay a much higher rate of tax in retirement than you did as a working person, that's unlikely, but it might happen, then the pension might not work for you. But especially if you're paying higher rates on the way in, and the 40% rate, obviously that's that that can create benefits, but the 45% rate is just even more so. And for people who are paying this very punitive, what we'll call a 60% rate of marginal tax, that's where their personal allowances were drawn on earnings over £100,000. It's not a real tax rate within the system, but it's an effective tax rate. They can have some astronomical boosts by putting that money, instead of taking it as salary, into a pension, some of which, you know, the tax relief will be automatic, some they're going to have to claim back through self-assessment. But they could get 112% uplift on their money if they then go on to withdraw it as a basic rate taxpayer. They might not, because they're probably high earners, so they may live as a 40% taxpayer, who knows. But still, they're going to get like a 75% uplift if they're a 40% taxpayer. So,
and this is particularly useful for people who are sort of at or close to those yeah. thresholds, because if you can, you know, if you can bring your tax rate down from 60, effectively 60, to 40%,
yeah,
by paying into a pension, then that is doubly effective.
And this point about, you know, you don't have to be 1 or 2 years away from retirement. I sit, you know, speak to you as in my mid to early 40s, and I'm not very close to being able to pull down pension money, but I can see it. It's, you know, it's sort of, it's coming for sure. And it's a real decision, because if you're putting money away now, maybe for putting it in ISAs, you should really be putting it away for, you know, 5 years, 5 to 10 years, ideally. You're getting to the point where actually a pension, you're not really losing much by putting it into a pension. And you look at these tax advantages, it really changes your thinking, doesn't it? And you sort of, it makes sense to go quite early in terms of a pension, because once it's in there, it can build and you have a higher base to compound your returns.
And I think also there's just a psychological impact here as well, that because of the restrictions on when you can access a pension, It's kind of you're saving yourself from yourself in a way,
yeah.
Because you can't, you know, I mean, then, you know, many of us you know, have had examples in the past where we've maybe dipped into an ISA because we wanted to, I don't know,
yeah,
replace the kitchen or whatever, right. And with a pension you just can't do that. So mm-hmm. actually there's quite a discipline that's created around that.
And we should say, you know, this is sort of one side of the equation. You know, this is money enjoys an uplift inside a pension. You're then taxed on the way out. But an article that I've been working on in the past week, and which people can find at fidelity.co.uk, the markets and insights section of the website, looks at these percentage uplifts that we've been talking about, but also what happens on withdrawals on the way out. And basically, it's the same story. A pension, broadly speaking, is going to be the best place for you to save. But that's just a mathematical point of view. Mm. You've got to look at all your circumstances, because there's other tax benefits of saving in ISAs. ISAs, it can be very valuable, can't it, to have.
And the flexibility has a real value.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, if you were trying to build a retirement income, it would be very advantageous to have ISA money there as well, because you can get at that tax-free on your withdrawals. That means you're not going to be, you can keep the other income that you have below a certain level. That's a very good advantage.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, Tom, that is absolutely loads for now, so we'll leave it there. Thank you an awful lot for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week.
Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. Investors should note that the views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. This information is not a personal recommendation for any particular investment. If you are unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to one of Fidelity's advisors or an authorised financial advisor of your choice. Overseas investments will be affected by movements in currency exchange rates, and investments in emerging markets can be more volatile than other more developed markets. Reference to the specific securities should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities and is included for the purposes of illustration only. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and all tax rules may change in the future. Withdrawals from a pension product may not be possible until you reach age 55, 57 from 2028. This podcast may not be reproduced or circulated without prior permission. No statements or representations made in this podcast are legally binding on Fidelity or the recipient. This podcast is meant only for UK residents and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation in any jurisdiction in which it may be unlawful to make such an offer or solicitation.